Welcome, mabuhay, bienvenidos to the First World Manila podcast. First World Manila, the brand that makes long-term economic planning, urban development, and cultural revitalization of Manila and the Philippines interesting to a wider audience. We do this via podcasts like the one you're listening to now, vlogs, and fine art. My name is Ronmon Rodrigo Calao Cuenca, CFA. I am the founder and director of First World Manila. All right, let's get to it. Today's episode is actually a follow-up to a vlog I just released called What the Philippines Can Learn from Japan. For those of you who have watched this vlog, which I released on YouTube, by the way, and of course I will leave the link in the description for you, for those who haven't seen it, but for those of you who have seen the vlog, you know that at the end of the vlog, I was talking about how there was so much more I wanted to expound on and I wanted to say, but I couldn't fit it into the short, several minutes long video that was published. The reason being is that people consume things differently, and I've learned through trial and error that the best format, at least for this brand, First World Manila, for more long format discussions is actually this podcast. Whereas for online video that goes onto Facebook and YouTube, it's better to do something that's kind of quick and punchy. And of course, it's very visual. So I'm also there to promote my own artwork and other things I'll be working on in the future for this brand. So here we are now with this podcast where I'm going to talk more about what the Philippines can learn from Japan. And here's a heads up, here's sort of a brief summary for those who are just coming in, and I highly recommend you watch my vlog, but anyways, as a quick summary, basically, my argument as, first of all, the video was trying to answer a question, why is Japan a rich Asian country and the Philippines is poor? And my answer, in my opinion, is that if you just, you know, looking beyond policies and things like that, the most fundamental thing is that its leaders, Japan's leaders, had a vision for the country and a national identity that they were promoting, and that's something that our leaders here at the time in the 1800s lacked. So it's funny because even though there are so many differences between our societies, there are some similarities between Japan and the Philippines. Well, first, we're both archipelagos. Second is that at the time, I focused on the 1800s when this sort of national consciousness of a modern nation state came to being in this part of the world and in Asia, neither country were completely united. So obviously we know, I mean, as many of you know, the Philippines didn't exist before colonization. We were obviously different socio-economic ethno-linguistic groups basically put together by colonization, first by Spain and then the United States. In a little bit of contrast, Japan did have a shogunate. They had an emperor and a shogunate, like a centralized government. But what maybe some of you or a lot of you don't know is that this sort of government was very it wasn't that strong. I would almost say that Japan was a loose confederation of different domains that had, you know, some loyalty to this Japanese emperor. And showed some fealty to the shogun, who was sort of like in charge of running the, you know, very loose central government. So Japan, in other words, wasn't a really united country the way it is now, at least in the early mid 1800s. The last thing I want to talk about that's interesting about both countries is that at the time, the 1800s, they both had a class of people there that in both countries that were educated and had been educated abroad as well, but they didn't necessarily own land. That's interesting. So you have You have the samurai in Japan and the ilustrados, so think Rizal, Del Pilar, Lopez Hayana, those guys here in the Philippines. They didn't necessarily own land, but they were educated. And the reason why this is important is that if you don't own land, then there's a possible incentive for you to change or reform a what is more or less a feudal society where landowners have a lot of money. So certainly in Japan, for example, all these different regions had their daimyo, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, but they had like a war. They were run by a regional warlord that the samurai sort of served in different capacities, and it was the warlords who kind of, I'm not sure if they own the land. I have to actually read up on that, but I do know that the samurai themselves didn't really own land. So that was a situation there when in the mid 1800s when the Americans arrived and basically forced Japan to open to trade. And Japan at this point had been closed off for several centuries. So they were still, while the rest of the world had guns and steam technology, Japan at that time were still samurais with swords, riding horses and everything. So going to the Philippines, a lot of the illustri I mean the I know the church owned a good amount of the land at the time, and a lot of these ilustrados, I mean, I'm sure there are people who owned some land. There were some it's a good amount of landowners, but I don't think it's sort of the hacienda culture maybe you see now, at least not to that extent, because again, the church, my understanding is that the church was the biggest landowner. Regardless, look at some of the ilustrados. José Rizal, again, our national hero, he wasn't from a wealthy landowning family. He was, I guess you would call him an upper middle class guy who was educated abroad. But that's so there are similarities. Again, an educated class that didn't necessarily own land. So that's interesting because they're sort of potentially those are the agents of change. I did list three things in the video about what the samurai did in the light of a Western, of seeing how far the West had advanced that totally changed society. First of all, a bunch of samurai from the outer domains that were never really, they weren't really doing so well with the shogun, the Tokugawa shogun at the time. Long story short, it's a really amazing story, so you should read it. But anyways, they basically overthrew the government, essentially a coup d'etat, these samurai, and created a modern version of Japan that was centered around the Meiji Emperor. This event was called the Meiji Restoration, and I really suggest that you guys take a look at it. Even Wikipedia, it's so fascinating. So, they basically these educated samurai staged a coup d'etat and created an entirely new nation. In the process of doing that, they did several things that I listed down, including creating a state-led economic development. let's see, the second one is, well, I forget, I'm actually blanking on the other one. There were three reasons that I talked about. I'm actually blanking on the second one. But the most important one I want to talk about right now is the fact that they completely changed society. So again, it's funny, we think about Japan now, like you always hear about how like people hide their wealth and class isn't really shown, at least not the way it is here. But before the Meiji Restoration, there was very much a there was it was very much a society divided by class. Again, you had the feudal lords and the samurai and the commoners, but they these samurai who got in charge completely changed this entire way of living in the span of one generation. First of all, they paid off the warlords, the daimyo, so they gave them early retirement so that they wouldn't get they wouldn't bother these samurai too much when they were reforming the country. But they also got rid of their own class. They got rid of the samurai class. They basically taxed the other samurai to death, not to death, but to retirement, and they opened government up to people, to people of all backgrounds. So there was a sense of merit in what they were doing. So that's the important thing. Again, merit, 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 which I always repeat in this podcast. So that sort of laid the groundwork for a lot of things there, and obviously, things went from there, and you have what you have today, or you have a first world Japan and a third world developing Philippines. So again, it's this combination of making their society. I mean, first of all, they didn't throw away like all their, rituals and their customs. Rather, they made it more accessible to people. It's more about merit now. So their high culture still existed. You think about like tea ceremonies, which I'll get to in a second, for example. Whereas it's almost like the opposite happened here in the Philippines, a lot of the ilustrados, and I'm not talking about our heroes like Rizal and Del Pilar and all of them, but a lot of them are wealthy. Did the opposite. They kept all the economic privileges to themselves, and they didn't make their culture accessible to people. They, as I mentioned, they kept people halfway educated. As I, quoting again Rizal, who I quoted last episode in the last episode of this podcast, like leaving the most people here halfway educated. Even then, at some point, they even forgot their own culture. I'll get to that in a second, or maybe in a later episode. But anyways, so it's not just about the policies. It's the culture that underlies it that supports everything. And again, the idea of a national character and identity that they use, and they educate the leaders of the society, educate people in who they are. Basically, they're marketing their nation to their citizens. So even today, an example of this, I went to Manila House a few weeks ago for a Japanese art exhibit there, and there were some Japanese, or I guess they're expats living here in Manila, and the artists and the people organizing this exhibit held a tea ceremony. It was a very modern one. Like some of the teacups were actually done by some of the artists who were exhibiting in this exhibit. But nevertheless, they did the whole tea ceremony and they explained it to the people watching. I mean, myself included, but also the Japanese who were there. So they, again, it's about education and learning about your tradition and customs. You're in the process of I mean, that's sort of a way that you nation build. You market the national culture to the people, so that yeah, this is what I'm part of, basically. Which again, the exact opposite happened here in my point of view. So they educate people on their high cult. They educate their citizens on their high culture and made it accessible and attainable from by merit, generally speaking. And of course, no country or nation is perfect, but obviously they did something right because the average standard of living in Japan is much better than the average standard of living here in the Philippines. Okay. Let's see. Okay. Before I start, I mean, I did talk about similarities and differences, so I mentioned some of these similarities between Japan and the Philippines in the 1800s, but there are also some stark differences. So the fact that there even was a shogunate and an emperor in Japan is completely different from here in the Philippines. There is nothing like that here. So that in a way, I always feel that in my opinion, that almost gives an advantage for a country to modernize quickly because there's I guess what I like to call an institutional memory. Like there's a certain there was a government that sort of consolidated duties and had a functioning bureaucracy that worked more or less. So even if you look at like pretty much all developed countries now, whether it's in the West or East Asia, like their societies stemmed from very strong kingdoms and empires, and obviously they've evolved past that. But like there's still like a functioning bureaucracy that I feel is a legacy of of these kings and queens and emperors and whatnot. Even in the U.S. or Australia or Canada, I mean, they come from the United Kingdom, which is a kingdom. So there's that. There's a sense of institutional memory and respect, or functioning bureaucracy. So that's one major difference. So maybe some of you might be thinking also, like, well, if that's true, then how is it that there are, call it former colonies in Latin America, some of them are doing pretty well. Like, I mean, Chile is doing well, for example, and they're technically from a former Spanish colony like us. Why are they doing relatively well? Well, my answer to that is that there were some differences. I mean, between Latin America and the Philippines, I think, and I talked about this with my friend. And a PhD in Filipiniana studies, Jorge Mojado. He was Spanish, and we were talking about that once, and he was telling me that, one major difference between Latin America, and the Philippines is that after Spain was kicked out of that region of the world, the Criollos took over, like basically the Europeans took over, and the mestizos were, I guess, underneath them. But like here in the Philippines, because we were so far from Spain and Europe, there were that many Criollos here. I guess the modern term, the colloquial for Criollos in the Philippines is Tisoy. But there aren't so many Tisoys here. Mostly the people who took over was the mestizo class. So like basically Rizal's social class. So it's different. It's a different society, almost a different culture, almost in that sense. So cut us some slack. We obviously have some odds stacked against us as a country. Okay, going back to Japan. What's amazing about Japan, this whole Meiji Restoration, is that this was basically, if we define revolution as, and I remember this from my history class in boarding school in the U.S. There's some we can have a difference. We can qualify a difference between revolution and war for independence. So some historians call like the U.S.'s freedom from the U.K. a war for independence. It was a conservative movement, for example. Like they actually wanted to keep things as is, and they basically revolt in a way. They revolted against the British because the British wanted more taxation for the United States. But a revolution is a complete overthrow of pre-existing order. So think about, and a lot of these are violent. So think about the French Revolution, in France, obviously, the communist revolutions in the Russia and China. Those are complete overthrows of the pre-existing society. And in some ways, some people call the Meiji Restoration a revolution from the top. So whereas in the French Revolution and maybe in China and Russia, you had a revolt by maybe those who at the time were kind of in the lower strata of society. In Japan, it was almost the opposite. It was the people in the upper echelons of society who completely upended the pre-existing order. I think that's amazing. So of course, they completely eliminated the old centuries-old feudal system and created this modern nation state in one generation. In one generation, they went from samurai with swords to defeating Russia in the, was it Russo-Japanese War? I think that's what it's called. Using guns, so that's pretty amazing. So again, we obviously did the opposite. And I wonder too, this idea of like of completely destroying a feudal system like that. I wonder if, and I'm just speculating at this point, I wonder if that leads to today where like, there are all these articles, and I guess maybe I'll share some in the description, but it's like the wealthy in Japan, they're generally not obvious with their wealth. They're not showy with it. There's a sense, because there's a stronger sense of, there might be a stronger sense of community. And then I remember reading about during the earthquake and tsunami in 2011 that hit Japan, like, There were no riots or anything like that, even though like m large swaths were of certain parts of the country were destroyed. So there's a sense of unity, I suppose, I'm assuming, with Japan and within Japanese. And it's crazy because again, it wasn't like that before. They definitely had a warlord problem, or or like a or kind of a very loose archipelago with warlords in it, the same way that we do, or we have now in some ways. But here, look at us. Like again, the rich live in villages, and they show off in all these society magazines and all these society sections of the newspaper. It's like they keep showing off. Look how amazing I am. Look how wealthy, and like look at all my servants. Which I talked about again in the previous podcast, Independence from Laziness. So that's in a sense what we can learn from Japan is that there is an educated class that cared about the country and had the means of changing things. Am I saying we should have a coup d'etat and all this stuff? Not at all. But the whole point of what I'm doing with First World Manila, and again, I'm targeting mainly the educated class here, is to show that we have to care about the country, and we can't run away and ignore these problems. I mean, A, people here need our help and who are suffering, and B, it's also I think in some ways that's almost like a mark against your soul. I'm not religious at all, but I think I can knot you and your sense of who you are if you don't if you're rich and educated, you just kind of leave this country and don't care about giving anything back, or you do, it's just lip service. Okay. I wanted to talk a bit about high culture, which I mentioned just now. So I talked about this tea ceremony and the fact that Japan, it's a much more there's more social mobility in terms of like it's not a rigid class system like it is here, but at the same time their high culture still exists. So again, like the emperor, they still have an emperor, for example. They have imperial palace. Those things still exist, but it's accessible to people. They make it accessible, and they make it, this is who we are. It's great marketing. But for us, even our elite, even our elite themselves are completely cut off from our high culture. Our ilustrado culture is gone, and we have to reclaim that because that is what's missing in our culture. The good parts we should reclaim, not the bad ones. So yeah, again, I'm very much for example, I'm very much pro people here understanding Spanish. And making Intramuros and Escolta more accessible. Again, there's no immediate ROI, return on investment on things like that, on culture. But in the short term, there's no ROI, but in the long term, there is. I refer to a study by JICA, which is the Japanese International Cooperation Agency. What a coincidence. There was a report on February 22 of this year is that they did a recent study about productivity loss here in the Philippines and traffic congestion and I guess it's Metro Manila, I'm not sure, but I just have the headline here. But traffic congestion now costs 3.5 billion pesos per day. So again, why can't we fix this? Because we can't get our infrastructure done. Why can't we get our infrastructure done? Because the government is full of red tape. Why can't we fix the red tape? Because there's nothing for people to aspire to do. Excuse me, I'm stuttering. There is nothing for people to aspire to do the hard work. Why? Because we don't have a culture to aspire to. So there's your long-term ROI for this country, or in this case, opportunity cost, as in opportunities foregone. So yeah, things like that. I mean, and there's a willpower to do that. I mean, look, I think I mentioned last time was that we have a highway now that takes one from Alabang, or the south, directly to the reclaimed area of Manila where you can gamble, and yet there is none that takes you straight to Intramuros, not too far, it was within that general area. So where do our priorities lie? I'm probably going to repeat that in future episodes in this podcast. Okay. I mean, culture does matter, and it's sad too because, I'm here, that all I see are villages and poverty, 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 and then mall condo, poverty, 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 mall condo, village here and there. It's sad because, or what's missing is again is our culture and our national identity. It's sad because I felt more Filipino and I felt more proud to be Filipino in Madrid than I do in my own city, in Manila. I walk around Madrid and I see what Escolta could have been. I see, Rizal's monument, the monument to Rizal there, and the Islas Filipinas street and train station. How crazy is that? I feel more proud to be Filipino abroad than I do here. I mean, what does that say? So again, culture does matter, and I want to leave you with this thought, with a few thoughts. I want to repeat something that I got from a marketing guru and entrepreneurship guru, Seth Godin. So he has an amazing podcast called Akimbo, which you guys should definitely listen to. It's really interesting. But culture is important. Culture matters. He's talking about that in a business context. But again, think culture does matter. People, and according to him, culture is like this. People like us do things like this. So even though he's talking about businesses and brands, it's the same thing for a country. I was even just mentioned, I was kind of foreshadowing that earlier when I talked about how the Japanese elite marketed their culture, a national culture and identity to the rest of the Japanese. People like us do things like this, right? And it doesn't have to be tied to ethnicity or religion. It could just be tied to values and sensibilities. So yeah, that's important. I guess before I forget too, I should mention that Japan is racially homogenous, so that's probably an easier, that makes it an easier sell. Whereas for us, we have a mestizo upper class and a native indigenous underclass in a lot of ways. Although still probably better than, I mean, class for me, if I had to decide what the bigger problem is in this country between race and class, I would say class is a much bigger problem than race because I think race here is more fluid. But still. That's still an advantage that Japan has over us in terms of selling a culture and a sense of identity to its citizens. But still, you see this sort of culture, people like us do things like this. You'll see it in a lot of developed countries, like even in the U.S. So, I've read criticisms against President Trump, for example, calling his actions and his behavior un-American. It is un-American to, start trade wars, for example. That's an example. It is un-American, right? People, I noticed that a lot of writers or critics of Trump, a good number of them use that term. His behavior is un-American. And again, in Japan, this is very, I will never forget this. So I was working in a private bank in Singapore at the time of the earthquake, and some of our employees are Japanese, and there was a this big. Everyone sent condolences to our Japanese employees, and one of them replied by email because there were these mass emails going on at the time, and he was just saying thank you for your condolences. I'm paraphrasing here, but basically he was saying thank you for your condolences. We can handle it. We are samurai. So we are samurai. People like us do things like this. Even like a friend of mine from Spain was saying like, yeah, don't worry. I mean, when I tell him have safe travels, example, he says, I'm Spanish. I'm a conquistador. Things like that. Even he's just saying that in jest, but again, there's a sense of identity and heritage that really is lacking in our own culture right now, or in our own national culture. I would like it for us one day so that in the event of like, say there's another earthquake happens or some tragedy happens to us, which hopefully never happens, but if we can say, we can say, don't worry, we can take care of ourselves and we'll rebuild and everything. Ilustrado kami. or Somos Ilustrados. I would like to say that. I would love a day when we can all say that, regardless of where you are financially, that you can say, I am an ilustrado or ilustrada. Again, talking about our high culture and our heritage, our very unique heritage. Some people may say, oh, this is colonial mentality, what I'm saying. Well, I don't think so. I mean, our national culture is a mix of different things, so we should learn to embrace that. I think it's great, especially now because that kind of, melting pot, multicultural thing is so, it's very much in vogue these days in terms of the global culture, the global zeitgeist. And even then, again, going back to the Japanese, like, it's not like they like dressed up as samurai. They continued to dress up as samurai, even though they kept the tradition. They adopted Western attire and even made it their own. They take things from the West and make it their own, like cars, electronics. I mean, they take it as something that's abroad, and they make it uniquely their own, uniquely Japanese. I have a suit. My favorite business suit is a Japanese cut suit. So even though it's a Western business suit, it's a Japanese cut, and it's my favorite suit. So if they can do that, we are doing that way before they were. So why not? Why do we look down on that? We should celebrate the fact that we're a mixed culture, a mestizo culture. For me, the real colonial mentality is perpetuating like a master and slave mentality, which I talked about again in the previous podcast, independence from laziness. Okay. But one more thing. Is this the last thing I want to talk about? Let me just check. I'm looking over my notes. Okay. Yeah, one more thing. I love how like sometimes in social media here in the Philippines, there'll be some news about like some Japanese politicians caught in a corruption scandal, and they resign right away, or they bow, or things like that, or they show that they're sorry, and then people always say, why can't our politicians be like this or be like that? And you're right, we should hold our politicians up to task. But let me make you think about that a second. For all the rich people here, and especially the people who are listening, because I know you're there, the people from the old rich families here, do you bow or say sorry for your boorish behavior? I mean, going around and flaunting your wealth while the rest of this country is suffering, I find that to be in poor taste. And again, so again, people who are rich, they have the cultural capital, especially the old rich. At the end of the day, you know who you are. You set the example for society, even above and beyond politicians, is my point of view. So if you don't apologize for your poor behavior and my own, right? Then why would anyone else? So if I just like ignore these problems, then I'm part of the problem. People, all the Filipinos watching this, like we're not divorced from the problem of this country. And then I think we again have a sense that we're all Filipino, regardless of where we live or what our ethnicity is or our religion or our economic background. So we have to that's the starting point. That's the seed where things have to change here. Yes. So, and again, I'm not saying like you can't, have like, high-end stuff or exclusive things, but like, and that stuff does exist. There's the tattler, obviously, for example, in every country, I think, but in a lot of developed countries, there's a tattler. But it's the attitude. It's like, look at how great I am, or look at all these servants serving me. Again, master and slave, with this sort of master and slave colonial mentality we have to get rid of. Okay. So, Spanish Tagalog vocab for today. Vosotras. So, kayo for babae. So if you're talking to, you were saying you, plural, for a bunch of women, mga babae, you say vosotras. So, kayo. And that wraps up another episode of the First World Manila podcast. If you like this, please do subscribe. on whatever podcast channel, podcast platform you're listening on this through. I also have a Facebook page, Instagram page. Yeah, so please do, and a website as well. Please, so anyways, please do subscribe, and I will see you next week. Have a good day. Goodbye.